The first time I realized I was managing a marriage that wasn't mine, I was standing in the refrigerated aisle of a high-end grocery store at 9 o'clock on a Tuesday night. I wasn't there for myself. I was holding a basket containing organic almond milk, a specific brand of low-sodium turkey breast, and a bottle of expensive Cabernet. My boss, Marcus, had texted me at 6:30, just as I was putting my keys in my ignition to go home, asking if I could swing by the market, because his wife was coming back from a business trip, and the house was empty. He'd said he was stuck in a budget meeting with the board. He'd said he didn't have a second to breathe. He'd said, "I don't know what I'd do without you." I remember the hum of the industrial coolers. It was a low, vibrating sound that seemed to sync up with the dull throb in my temples. I looked down at the turkey breast and wondered how I had become the person who knew exactly which brand of deli meat a woman I had met, exactly twice, preferred for her midnight snacks. I was a project manager for a private hospital network. I had a degree in health administration. I managed multi-million dollar capital improvement budgets. Yet here I was, checking expiration dates for a man who earned 3 times my salary. The secret anchor of my life at that time was a small silver key on my personal keychain. It didn't belong to my apartment or my car. It was the key to Marcus's private desk drawer at the office. Not his filing cabinet, the drawer where he kept his backup blood pressure medication, his spare cufflinks, and a stack of handwritten cards from his wife that he never seemed to find the time to read. He had given it to me 6 months into the job, telling me he trusted me more than anyone else in the building. At the time, I felt a rush of professional pride. I thought it meant I was indispensable. I didn't realize that being indispensable is just a polite way of saying you are being consumed. The hospital network was expanding, and the pressure was immense. We were opening 3 new outpatient clinics in the suburbs, and the logistics were a nightmare. But my days weren't filled with vendor contracts or zoning permits. They were filled with Marcus. It started with small things. "Can you remind me to call the florist? Can you find a nice restaurant for our anniversary?" Then it shifted into emotional territory. He would sit in my office, door closed, and talk for 40 minutes about how his wife didn't understand the pressure he was under. He would lean back in his chair, eyes closed, and tell me that I was the only person who truly saw how hard he worked. I would sit there, my hands hovering over my keyboard, watching my unread emails climb into the hundreds. I felt a strange flickering sense of power. I was the keeper of his vulnerability. I was the one who kept the engine of his life greased and running. But underneath that power was a growing, cold numbness. I was 32 years old, and I didn't have time to see my own friends because I was too busy ensuring his life looked perfect from the outside. One afternoon, about 8 months in, the office phone on my desk rang. It was an internal line, but the display showed it was a transfer from the main reception. "Is Marcus there?" a woman's voice asked. It was sharp, brittle. I recognized it immediately as Sarah, his wife. "He's in a meeting with the regional directors," I said, using the standard shield I had perfected. "I can take a message?" There was a long pause. I could hear the sound of a television in the background of her end. "He told me he was in the city," she said. "He said he wouldn't have cell service in the parking garage, but I called the city office and they said he never arrived." My heart did a slow, heavy roll in my chest. I looked toward Marcus's closed door. I knew he wasn't in a meeting. He was in there, taking a nap on his leather sofa, because he'd stayed up too late watching game film of his son's high school football team. He'd asked me to tell everyone he was unavailable until 3. "I'm sure there's just a misunderstanding with the scheduling," I said. My voice sounded thin to my own ears. "I'll have him call you as soon as he's free." I hung up and felt a wave of genuine nausea. I wasn't just his project manager. I wasn't even just his work wife, a term the nurses in the cafeteria used with a wink that made my skin crawl. I was his alibi. I was the structural integrity of a lie I didn't fully understand. The smell of the office always hits me when I think about that month. It was a mix of expensive floor wax, stale coffee, and the faint ozone scent of the high-capacity printers. It was the smell of efficiency. But our corner of the executive suite didn't feel efficient. It felt heavy. It felt like walking through waist-high water. A few days after the phone call, Marcus asked me to come into his office. He looked haggard. He hadn't shaved cleanly, and there was a coffee stain on his silk tie. "I need a favor," he said. It wasn't a question. It was an opening of a gate. Sarah's sister is having a birthday party this weekend. I told her I have to be in the office on Saturday to finalize the construction bids for the East Side Clinic. I waited. I knew what was coming. I need you to actually be here, he said, just for a few hours, in case she calls the landline, or in case she stops by with the kids to bring me lunch. If she sees your car in the lot, she'll believe I'm actually working. But the bids are already done, Marcus, I said. I sent them to you on Tuesday. He waved his hand as if swatting away a fly. I know, but we can go over the staffing models again, or you can just catch up on your own stuff. I just need the optics. I looked at him. I saw the desperation in his eyes. But for the first time, I didn't see a powerful man under pressure. I saw a man who had delegated the labor of his own integrity to me. He wanted me to hold the weight of his marriage, so he didn't have to feel the pinch of it. The practical consequence of speaking up was obvious. Marcus was my direct supervisor. He controlled my performance reviews, my bonus structure, and my path to a director role. If I said no, I wasn't just refusing a weekend shift. I was rejecting the intimacy he had forced upon me. I was breaking the special bond that he used to justify the fact that I was doing two people's jobs for one person's pay. The consequence of staying silent was becoming a ghost in my own life. I was already disappearing. I was a collection of his preferences, his schedules, and his excuses. I didn't say no that day. I went in on Saturday. I sat in my silent office for 6 hours. My car was the only one in the executive lot. I sat there and watched the clock, feeling the seconds tick away like drops of water from a leaky faucet. At noon, the phone rang. I didn't answer it. I let it ring and ring until it stopped. Then it started again. 10 minutes later, I saw a white SUV pull into the lot. It was Sarah. She sat in the car for a long time, looking at my Honda. She didn't come inside. She just turned around and drove away. I felt like a criminal. I had done nothing wrong, and yet I was covered in the soot of his deception. I realized then that I couldn't admit the biggest truth of all. I liked being needed. I had mistaken his dependency for my own value. I had thought that by fixing his life, I was proving I was a natural leader. But leadership isn't cleaning up someone else's mess. It's not being the person who knows where the spare cufflinks are kept. The following Monday, the atmosphere had shifted. Marcus was clipped, professional, and avoided eye contact. He didn't ask me about my weekend. He didn't ask me to get him coffee. He was terrified. He knew Sarah had been to the office, and he didn't know what I had seen or heard. Around 2 o'clock, he buzzed my intercom. Can you come in here? I walked into his office. The air felt cold. He was sitting behind his desk, his hands clasped tightly. Sarah mentioned she saw your car here on Saturday, he said. He tried to make it sound casual, but his voice went up a half octave. Did you see her? I didn't. I lied. I had the blinds closed. I was focused on the staffing models. He exhaled, a long, shaky breath. Right. Good. Listen, I think we need to tighten things up around here. I've noticed the filing for the East Side project is a bit behind, and your overtime hours are getting a bit high. We might need to look at the budget for your department. It was a warning shot, a blatant, clumsy threat. He was punishing me for the very silence I had provided him. He was making sure I knew that if the ship went down, I would be the first one tossed overboard to lighten the load. I went back to my desk and looked at the silver key on my keychain. I felt a sudden sharp clarity. It was the feeling of a fever breaking. The next day, I didn't bring him his morning brief. I didn't check his personal email. I sat at my desk, and I worked on the project management software. At 10 o'clock, he walked out of his office, looking confused. Where's the summary for the board meeting? He asked. It's in the shared drive, Marcus. I said, I didn't look up from my screen. I've transitioned all project files to the digital folder, so the whole team has access. He stood there for a moment. He looked like he'd been slapped. But we usually go over it together. I like your notes in the margins. I think it's better if we keep the process standardized, I said. It's more efficient for the audit trail. His face darkened. I see. That afternoon, he asked me to book a flight for his mother to come visit for the holidays. He handed me his personal credit card, the one he kept in the silver-keyed drawer. I can't do that, Marcus, I said. My voice was steady, though my heart was hammering against my ribs so hard I thought it might bruise. "Excuse me? Booking personal travel isn't in my job description," I said. "And from a compliance standpoint, I shouldn't be handling your personal financial information. I'm happy to give you the number for the travel agency we use for the hospital." He stared at me. The silence in the room was absolute. I could hear the hum of the HVAC system, a dry mechanical breath that seemed to fill the space between us. "After everything I've done for you," he whispered, "after the way I've looked out for your career, you've looked out for your own convenience," I said, "and I've helped you do it. But I'm done being the buffer." I took the silver key off my ring. I didn't hand it to him. I put it on the edge of his desk. It made a small, clinical clink as it hit the wood. The fallout was immediate. Within 48 hours, I was called into a meeting with human resources. Marcus had filed a formal complaint about insubordination and performance issues. He claimed that I had become unreliable and that my attitude was affecting the department's morale. I sat in the HR office, a windowless room that smelled of industrial carpet cleaner. The HR director, a woman named Ellen, who had always been friendly to me, looked pained. "Marcus is very upset," she said. "He says the working relationship has broken down. He's suggesting a transfer to the records department, or a voluntary resignation." I looked at the folder in front of her. I knew what was in it. A hand-picked selection of my failures. The times I hadn't responded to his late-night texts about groceries. The times I had insisted on talking about budgets instead of his marriage. "I have a log," I said. Ellen paused. "A log. For the last 3 months, I have kept a record of every non-work-related task I was asked to perform," I said. "The grocery trips, the personal gift shopping, the hours spent acting as a personal confidante, the weekend I spent in the office as an alibi for his wife. I have the timestamps of the texts. I have the receipts I was asked to submit for reimbursement that weren't for hospital business. I wasn't angry. I was just tired. The exhaustion was so deep it felt like it was in my bones. I'm not going to records," I said, "and I'm not resigning. If Marcus can't work with me because I've set professional boundaries, then we need to discuss a severance package that reflects the actual work I've been doing for this network." The room went very quiet. Ellen looked at me, and for a second I saw a flash of something in her eyes. It wasn't pity. It was recognition. She had probably been someone's work wife 20 years ago. She knew exactly what the cost was. They didn't fire me. They couldn't. The work-wife narrative is a powerful tool for a boss until it's documented. Once the emotional labor is quantified, it becomes a liability. They moved me to a different division, a lateral move in title, but a massive leap in sanity. I was no longer in the executive suite. I was in a bright, loud office with four other project managers and a boss who didn't know my middle name and didn't care to. The first week in the new role, I felt like a diver coming up for air too fast. My lungs ached. I kept waiting for my phone to buzz. I kept checking the clock at 6 p.m., wondering if someone needed almond milk or a lie told to their spouse. I saw Marcus one more time, about a month later. We passed each other in the cafeteria. He was walking with his new assistant, a girl who couldn't have been more than 24. She was carrying two cups of coffee and a dry cleaning bag. He didn't look at me. He looked through me, as if I were a piece of furniture that had been moved to a different room. I sat down at a table with a plastic tray and a salad that tasted like nothing. My phone stayed dark in my pocket. I had my evenings back. I had my dignity back. But I also had the realization that the version of me Marcus liked, the organized, empathetic, indispensable woman, was a ghost. She was a performance I had given until the theater burned down. I still have a habit of checking the office phone directory. I see his name there, still in the same position, still holding the same power. And sometimes, I see the light in his old office window, late at night, when I'm leaving the building. I know someone is in there with him. I know someone is listening to him talk about how misunderstood he is. I know someone is holding a silver key. I used to think I was protecting him. Now I know I was just protecting the part of myself that didn't think I deserved a job that was just a job. I am 33 now. I have a new keychain. It only has two keys on it, my apartment and my car. When I go to the grocery store on a Tuesday night, I only buy things that I am going to eat. I stand in the aisle and I look at the almond milk, and I feel a strange, quiet triumph in the fact that I have no idea who else in this building might need it. The silence is the best part. It took me 3 years to realize that being indispensable to a man who won't manage his own life is just another way of being invisible. I'm visible now. I'm just a project manager. And for the first time in my career, that is exactly enough.